On behalf of all of us at Eastern Mennonite University, faculty, staff, students, welcome to what I believe will be a rich weekend of interaction around the theme Leadership into the Common Good, an Anabaptist Perspective. You will notice, I'm sure, in your program materials, the conference sponsors and co-sponsors, but let me name them in particular, Eastern Mennonite University School of Graduate Professional Studies, Everence, Mennonite Central Committee, Mennonite Economic Development Associates, Mennonite Health Services, and the Anabaptist Center for Religion and Society, which is located here on our campus. Co-sponsors, Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary, Bethel College, Bluffton University, Canadian Mennonite University, Conrad Grebel University College, Goshen College, Heston College, and Eastern Mennonite University. For a number of us here at EMU, this has been a most unusual week. Last Saturday, our MA in Counseling Program and Institute for Experiential Therapies hosted Dr. Daniel Goldman of Emotional Intelligence fame for a day-long seminar here in this location and an evening dinner presentation. By Saturday noon, this weekend, we ought to know how to be leaders. Over the years, I've made a number of observations about leadership and how leaders are perceived. Some of them are appropriate only for a more limited, smaller audience. But one conundrum that I've never quite been able to explain, if one leads in a direction that someone in the group or organization does not wish to go, is that leadership? That comes to mind rather frequently these days. When it's not uncommon for someone to make a passionate plea for stronger leadership, occasionally one is tempted to respond, "That's what I thought I was attempting to do. Apparently you have questions." But then I'm reminded that a response like that wouldn't likely pass the test of emotional intelligence. So if you have an answer to that conundrum, let me know. I'd be eager to hear it. Again, welcome to all of you. And now it's my pleasure and honor to introduce two student leaders from Eastern Mennonite University. They are serving as co-presidents of the Student Government Association, Hannah Heishman and Rachel Schrock. Both are graduating seniors. Hannah was raised in an intentional community near here in Keeseltown, Virginia. She's a peace building and development major with minors in gender and political studies. Within the next year, she's planning on working for refugee resettlement and would ultimately like to go to grad school to work in urban planning. Rachel says her home is, quote, beautiful and bountiful Kelowna, Iowa. Her words, not mine. I'm guessing she did very well in creative writing. She's majoring in art with minors in psychology and photography. And her immediate plans are to explore internship opportunities in the social services, and she is particularly interested in community organizing, leading collaborative art projects, and additional interests are travel, art therapy, pastoral ministry, photojournalism. Please join me in welcoming our student co-leaders of the SGA, Hannah and Rachel.
Thanks, Lauren, for that introduction. So I'll admit it, I know what ineffective leadership feels like. In my first years at EMU, I was the easily excitable freshman who filled her weeks with meetings and countless events. I got caught up in a routine of try and take on and left a little room for tending emotional or spiritual self-care. I felt energized by exploration of leadership, but as I spread myself among different student groups, I became less and less grounded. In this way, my leadership felt like a facade. I would run from role to role with ideas and thoughts that rarely came to full fruition. And then I got burnt out. Apathy hit, and I was suddenly completely disengaged. I needed space for discerning what warranted my energy. Thankfully, I got away from the hum of campus and spent nearly 4 months in southeastern Europe. This was a time of searching and ultimately renewal. Life became slower, and consequently, my actions became more and more intentional. In travel, I simultaneously witnessed larger systems and intimate networks of individuals. I learned how to listen to needs and respond with creativity and carefulness. This was valuable leadership formation.
Compared to Rachel, I was the slow start. I was the embodiment of hesitation, of pauses. My first year at AMU was characterized by tedious, careful, and measured experimentations with extracurriculars. My freshman and sophomore year, I stayed safe within the realms that I knew I could occupy and own. I knew my sphere of influence and operated exclusively within it. Thankfully, this trend was jolted my junior year. I studied abroad for a semester on a cross-cultural program, and the world opened herself up to me. Often, I was asked to speak about issues that were bigger than myself, issues that I felt, though I had no authority to speak into. All of this responsibility was given to me merely because our group was American, and it was assumed that we held a piece of the story. The semester abroad was invigorating for me. I realized that adventure made me come alive. I was also able to realize my own power. Returning back to school felt daunting. I wondered how I could maintain such an enthusiastic perspective on life while confined to the Harrisonburg community. Ultimately, and thankfully, I realized that adventure and possibility lie in every system and every person. I realized that tapping into adventure was less about exploring and more about choosing to engage. Our second semester of our junior year was characterized for both of us as a bit of a mad frenzy. I was ecstatic to engage in every protest, every club, and every conference that the university offered. Moments felt overwhelming, but it was simultaneously so incredible. We were learning of the diversity that we never knew existed. Before, we were discovering the capacity of students, and we were learning what made EMU so unique and how to journey alongside of others. During the semester, Rachel and I realized how gifted we are at listening. We invited many people into our home and listened as they poured out their stories. When presented with problems, we brainstormed together and creative solutions collaboratively. Running to become SGA co-presidents felt like the most natural progression. We were able to facilitate conversations, and we knew that we would be able to speak into truths that we knew. Our goal as SGA co-presidents has always been to facilitate, to actualize the power that people already hold, and to connect people to resources that they need to make change. Leadership, for me, is less about having an overarching vision and more about engaging, being willing and able to listen, to exist in co-collaboration, and to dream together. If we want to orient ourselves as leaders for the common good, we must be in communion with the larger population. Leaders need to be connected and deeply rooted in relationship if their goal is to create community and collaborative space. So often, an overarching vision inhibits people from creating generative and creative solutions. A leader sees potential in people and in communities, journeys alongside, and in the process unlocks possibilities that reside unappreciated. Leadership can facilitate the most divine connection, that there is something unmistakable about the deep connection and energy that's created when people feel seen, heard, and valued. Leadership is connection. Leadership is about bringing all the different voices to the table, making sure that their eyes meet, and establishing that community composes the common good. Leadership is about prioritizing marginalized and different voices, acknowledging the value that others bring, and helping ideas come to fruition.
I still hold the tendency to overextend myself. My leadership experience is limited, and I'm still learning how to lead. It can be difficult to embody the ideals of leadership when faced with practical and logistical realities. People are complex, and we do not exist in a vacuum. Leading is not as simple as performing up to ideals. Leadership for me has become more malleable and dynamic as I become more aware of my strengths and shortcomings as I lead others. I recognize myself as an affiliative leader, one who promotes conflict mediation and collaboration. Both Hannah and I have utilized our positions with the student government to be facilitators. It has been our intention to create a space where people feel encouraged, heard, and valued. This approach, though certainly not all-encompassing, has enabled more collaboration and appreciation. To exemplify this claim, our Union of Student Organizations has been incredibly active this year, a space specifically devoted to collaboration. Leaders from different groups work towards common goals and the common good of the university. SGA is also energized by current plans of SpringFest, where student groups and clubs will represent themselves through booths, fundraisers, and art projects. We anticipate this event will be one of celebratory togetherness. After experiencing and knowing what ineffective leadership feels like, we have learned definitively what effective leadership feels like. Effective leadership feels like being listened to, being heard, and being seen. Effective leadership pulls on the strengths of communities and understands that solutions exist within the grassroots. From our narrative, a few takeaways can be garnered. The first, and perhaps most important, is the need for specialization. Instead of trying to do everything and be everyone, find your niche. The second, in order to find your niche, listen to yourself. Make sure that you tend to your spiritual and emotional needs. Find a space where you feel life and energy. The third is to remember to extend the same grace of listening to those around you. People thrive when they're listened to, and vulnerable spaces lead to growth, innovation, and change. We're extremely honored to be sharing with you all today, and the process of reflecting on what leadership means to us was valuable. When have we fumbled? When have we found a rhythm to leadership? When have we contributed to the common good on campus? In considering these questions, our definition of leadership organically revealed itself. Now we look to fellow leaders from this university. We'll be hearing from Roxy Allen Kiyoko and Dr. David Brubaker.
Roxy Allen Kiyoko is an instructor in the business department here at EMU. She has over 10 years of experience in the social change sector. She is a doctoral student at James Madison University School of Strategic Leadership Studies with a concentration in nonprofit and community leadership. Her research interests include social entrepreneurship, accountability, and governance.
Dr. David Brubaker is an associate professor of the Organizational Studies at Eastern Mennonite University and regularly teaches in the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding and the MBA program. He has more than 25 years of experience in workplace mediation, training, and organizational consulting. Brubaker has 10 years of leadership and management experience, including 5 years as executive director for Community Development Organization in Arizona. Please join us in welcoming Roxy Allen Kiyoko and Dr. David Brubaker.
Thank you very much. So welcome, everybody. We're so glad that you're here. So Dave and I will be serving as your co-hosts and co-moderators for this conference for this weekend. Our theme is Leading into the Common Good, an Anabaptist Perspective. The conference is inspired by the life work of Ori Miller, who led the development of multiple Anabaptist institutions during the 20th century, a century with two world wars, social and political upheaval, and an increasingly diverse church. Ori's leadership exemplifies leadership for the common good, as he answered a calling to serve by organizing Quiet Mennonites to make a difference in the areas of education, missions, peacemaking, post-war reconstruction, and mental health. Over these few days, we invite you to listen to speakers and share your experiences of leadership for the common good as we collectively reflect on what Anabaptist leadership has to offer the 21st century and the future, which faces even more complex problems than perhaps were faced in the 20th century. So we invite you to reflect on how and where is God calling us to act and serve.
And I would add my welcome to Roxy's. We're going to be doing a lot of introductions in this first session, but then fewer in subsequent sessions. Just wanted to say a word about the schedule, and you will have it in your program packets that were given to you coming in. Just so you know the flow of things, these sessions were really organized by our graduate and professional division. Jim Smucker, graduate dean, Shirley Ewald, and Sarah Williams did the work to put this together. In fact, would you join me in thanking them for that work? And you'll see a flow that really takes us from looking backwards to looking forward. And this evening, we're going to be gathering again here at 7 o'clock. We'll shortly be introducing our speakers for this afternoon. Very much encourage you to come back here at 7 to hear Brian Welsh, who had worked with Mother Earth News and will be talking about inspiring change in the new millennium. Tomorrow morning, we'll again gather here at 8:30. Peter Block will join us electronically, author of several very significant books, including Community, the Structure of Belonging, well worth hearing. We will then have an opportunity to raise international flags in our university commons during a chapel time, and at 11 o'clock, gathering back in this room, why Anabaptist values matter to my generation and Anabaptist values in practice. Friday afternoon, we have workshop sessions. We'll say more about that before we dismiss Friday morning. And in the evening, a focus on values and values-based engagement by leaders with several very skilled local leaders. Saturday morning, we will be looking at a theology of Anabaptist leadership and also having an opportunity to apply that in practical ways through a World Cafe model that Roxy and I will lead. So that's the next 3 days, if we include this evening, tomorrow, and Saturday morning. Also want to introduce our artist in residence. The person who is already beginning to design something is Janine Oberg. She is a CJP alumna, originally from South Africa, lives in this community with her husband and their child. And she is going to be charting what we are talking about in an artistic way during our days together. At the end of the time, we'll have a chance to hear from Janine about some of her interpretation. But this is an additional way of knowing. Beyond the words that you'll hear, you'll see the images that Janine is developing as well. And now we're going to move into our three speakers for this afternoon session. It's my privilege to introduce Johanna C. Johanna is a business and management major, a senior, and she's at Canadian Mennonite University. She joined us all the way from Winnipeg, although I'm not sure our weather is any better. But we're delighted to have you. Please come up, Johanna. The podium is yours.
Everyone wants to save the world, but no one wants to help mom with the dishes, especially millennials, especially on lasagna night. A lot of people seem to think that millennials are a pain. Just a couple years ago, Time magazine released an article titled Millennials, the Me, Me, Me Generation, which called millennials lazy, entitled, self-obsessed narcissists. That might be true, but you're stuck with us. By 2025, millennials will make up 75% of the workforce. It's no secret that millennials are slowly becoming the dominant generation. So the question should be, how can we prepare them for the future? Current models of leadership and decision-making will not remain effective without taking into account the characteristics of this rising generation. How do we get millennials to care about doing the dishes? As a millennial myself, I can tell you that there are many positive traits of this generation. The same Time magazine article calls us pragmatic idealists, tinkerers more than dreamers, and life hackers. We are the most educated generation yet. We are connected and tech-savvy, living in a world permeated with social media. We are great multitaskers. We have a strong sense of community, both locally and globally, and gather around causes that we are passionate about. We want meaning in our work rather than just being another gear in the machine. We are team-oriented and crave collaboration. We like to surround ourselves with those who are like-minded and have similar interests and beliefs, while we are also more accepting of differences. And we have a certain approach to control, power, and influence. We see the world in a particular way, and that guides us in how we make our decisions. Millennials grew up with constant praise, and so we often feel overqualified for the jobs that we have or the jobs that we look for. Though we are able to multitask, this also means that we are easily distracted. We want instant gratification and recognition, seeking purpose in our tasks and needing constant feedback. We also want work-life balance and flexibility. We are not as willing as former generations to sacrifice our personal lives. We appreciate transparency, and so we want people to be upfront about goals and expectations. We also value opportunities to advance. This means that autocratic styles of leadership and hierarchies are less accepted by millennials, whereas emotional leadership styles, such as visionary, coaching, and democratic leadership styles, are more attractive. A visionary style appeals to millennials, being pragmatic idealists, giving focus to a tendency to strive for innovation and change. Coaching allows millennials the independence that they seek while supporting them to succeed. And a democratic style fits the need for participation as millennials want to be part of the decision-making process. We value participatory decision-making, wanting full participation, mutual understanding, inclusive solutions, and shared responsibilities. We also want flatter organizational structures and crave chances to try things on our own. It's one thing for millennials to want certain things in leadership and decision-making, but it's another for them to work under these structures. What happens when professors put us into group projects? In my experience, often, we sit around and we stare at one another until someone takes the lead. We still need a leader, someone who will take initiative. In practice, there's still a hierarchy in place. Though millennials want flatter organizations, perhaps what we really want is just to feel as though we are equal, to be given attention as how our culture has shaped us. Or perhaps we simply just don't like titles. What we were asking for and what we want seem to be at odds. And so just because millennials are asking for certain things, it doesn't mean that those things are good for us. What is necessary then is to compensate for the strengths and weaknesses of the millennial generation. While being arrogant about our place in the world, glued to technology, and easily distracted, millennials are also an optimistic, driven, and creative generation whose strengths need to be harnessed. We need a model that takes into account the people that are being led. So baby boomer managers, entrepreneurs, and leaders should reevaluate what it means to be a millennial and empower them to take more initiative. The ideal is to structure organizations for initiatives. We need leaders who will give millennials a stake in the project, who will help us set goals to give direction and focus, and who will help us to be more self-aware by building our emotional intelligence competencies. Leaders who will also teach millennials to work for long-term causes rather than jumping from one cause to another or spreading ourselves too thin with too many causes to care about. We need mentors who share their experiences with us and support us in our work and passions. As many current leaders are baby boomers, they must recognize that there are many strengths to be leveraged from millennials, and millennials can learn from the experiences of the generations before it. For this to happen, it is important to understand where millennials are coming from. We grew up in a world of abundance, which can make us seem entitled. Because there are many options to us, we are more likely to postpone decision-making. Because of globalization and increased communication, we are constantly on social media and have a fear of missing out. But we can learn and use these things to our advantage. Millennials challenge conventions and are eager to find new and better ways of doing things. And so along with the knowledge and experience the boomers bring, this makes for a winning combination. Millennials have a fear of missing out, so we want to participate. We are informed but inactive, so we need to be rallied together for causes and pushed to think critically about practical solutions. We want to be involved and we want to change the world, but sometimes we don't know what steps to take. We can dream the big dreams, but we might not know how to get there. We need to be shown that the dishes are worth doing, that the little things lead to big things. We need to be given platforms and structures that push us and support us to make changes we want to see, because those changes are going to happen, for better or for worse. We don't need each generation to mirror the ones before it. We just need each generation to succeed. We don't necessarily need new models of leadership and decision-making. We will become them. At the present, we still have a chance to shape the future that we want. So next time it's lasagna night, we'll wash, you wash, we'll dry.
Thank you, Johanna. So now it is my pleasure to introduce our next two speakers for this afternoon. John Sharp teaches history and Bible at Heston College. He has served as a pastor, director of the Mennonite Church USA Historical Committee and Archives, and is the author of several books on Mennonite history and heritage, including a recent book which inspired this conference entitled My Calling to Fulfill, The Ori O. Miller Story. Rachel Waltner Goosen is an assistant professor of history at Washburn University and is a Kansas native. Her areas of interest in teaching and research are 20th century U.S. history, women's history, peace studies, and Mennonite history. Rachel has published several books, including one entitled Women Against the Good War, Conscientious Objection and Gender on the American Homefront, and others featuring the history of Newton, Kansas. So please help me welcome John to the stage, and then Rachel will follow John's talk.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk once more about Ori Miller. First, I'd like to give a brief overview of Ori's ministry and life, and then we'll take a look at leadership qualities, traits, and so on. But first, I should know my audience. How many here have worked with Ori Miller, perhaps called into service by Ori Miller? You knew Ori personally? Not bad. How many of you knew about Ori, but perhaps never worked with him? How many of you have no idea who Ori Miller was? I'm hoping there are some of you, because I have some things for you. I've been carrying around these superlative quotations of Ori Miller. And just a very quick overview. This is why Ori was busy most of the time. Ori was the oldest of 11 children, born to a Middlebury, Indiana farming family. You see him in the back, in the center, which was where he functioned in his family. In the center. He started early with delegation. I'm told by family members that when his father, D.D. Miller, was gone, which was often, Ori would be given the task of making sure work got done, which he did by delegating to his siblings. After high school, he taught country school for a few years. Then came to Goshen College. At Goshen College, he met the Mennonite world. At Goshen College, he received a classic education in Old Goshen before it was remade in 1924. He was the principal and primary teacher of the Goshen College School of Business while he was earning his bachelor's degree in English. Here he is with his faculty. And there he met Elta Wolf, surely the most important thing ever for him, and it cast his future. uncharacteristically, their first date happened this way. Ori and a friend decided they'd do a double date. And when they went to pick up their dates, they hadn't decided who would be with whom. And Ori was not yet the decisive Ori, and he said, "I'll take the one who comes down second." And it was Elta Wolf. This appeared in Jill Fry, granddaughter's attic, after the book was done. This is a contract that Ori Miller wrote when he and Elta Wolf were engaged, deciding to be married. This says something about his penchant for organization and spelling it all out. Just a few lines: "Be it hereby resolved by Ori O. Miller and S. Elta Wolf on this first day of the year, from henceforth, we will serve to strive." I'm sorry, you can read it better than I can. Strive to do what? Okay, all right. And then a list of things that they promise each other that they will do. And that includes the kind of things they will read. It includes that they will have daily devotions, daily Bible reading. It means they will never speak ill of the other, and so on and so on. Finally, that we will remain faithful members of the Mennonite Church and will be true to its principles as nearly as we understand them. That gives him a little bit of an out. That we will not fight with each other during the coming year. They had discussions. That we will sleep 8 hours each night. And he did. That we will believe in each other at all times and under all circumstances. The organizational genius of Ori Miller is already apparent. After graduation, they moved to Akron, Pennsylvania, where Elta has lived, and where Elta's father, A.N. Wolf, is a partner in the Miller Hess Shoe Company. Consequently, Ori is employed by the company, by his father-in-law, first as a salesman. A Sunday afternoon conversation on the porch with A.N. and Anna Wolf, in the house that A.N. had prepared, remodeled, and ready for them by the time they were married. He married Elta Wolf, and when she died sometime later in life, he married Elta Miller, Elta Sensenig Miller. Now, this is part of his efficiency. He didn't have to learn a new name, nor did he have to take the chance that he would misname his second wife. He worked with Miller Hess Shoe Company. He became a managing partner, eventually chairman of the board. But his first job was in sales. And Ori would travel the countryside with shoe samples to sell shoes to wholesale dealers and to stores. Eventually, there were a number of affiliates, including these here, and his roles, which build until in 1962, he becomes chair of the board. Miller Hess Shoe Company now houses 10,000 villages, which I think is an appropriate kind of tribute to Ori and his worldwide vision. It wasn't where Ori was going to go. Ori always believed that he would follow his father and become a pastor and evangelist. He went through the lot at Ephrata Mennonite Church 3 times and was never chosen. Their first time it happened, he had no idea why that happened. He was entirely confused. But after the 3rd time, and actually there was a 4th time, he eventually found his gift in administration. Luckily so, because his speaking was not at the top of the line. People listened to him for his content, not for his charisma. Peter Dick liked to tell the story, probably stretched just a bit, that he was sitting at a conference and Ori Miller was speaking, and a man arrived late and sat by him, and this man said, after a while, I wish this guy would finish. He's such a poor speaker. I can't wait to hear Ori Miller. I came to hear Ori Miller. Peter Dick said, that's Ori Miller. His beginning, his worldwide travels and interest in service, far beyond the hometown of Akron, Pennsylvania, happened in 1919 when he, along with nine others, went to Beirut and the region to do relief work after World War I. He was a genius at connecting people. He wrote diaries everywhere he went in great detail, and he wrote letters, and he sent them to everybody. And eventually they ended up in the church press. He knew something about building community. His second overseas venture was with MCC as one of the first three volunteers for this new fledgling service agency that combined Mennonite groups into a service agency. He was eminently practical. He did what got the job done, including working with the U.S. Navy to cross the Black Sea. Several times he rode on this destroyer, the Whipple. He also took Eastern Mennonite missions into Africa. He had his detractors, especially when it came to advocating peace. World peace was not something that every Mennonite was willing to sign on to. Non-resistance, biblical non-resistance, yes, but not pacifism. And so there were a series of conversations, letters, and sketches on this point. He was a lifelong supporter of Mennonite education. And there were also some detractors who believed that Mennonite education was losing its way. He was one of the architects of civilian public service, the alternative service program during World War II. I show this for two reasons. Those street signs are in Philadelphia, in the Paraguay Chaco, where he spent much time helping to get the settlements moving, going, troubleshooting. He said he'd been there at least 30 times. And here, Harold Bender, his colleague, and Ori Miller are both remembered every time somebody crosses this street. What were the qualities of Ori's leadership? It's always a combination of personality, natural talent, learned skills, in the context of family and church for Ori. He was deeply committed to the church. This was his primary agency, his way of serving the world beyond the local communities. He always said his father gave him a head start. His father was well known in the church, and so Ori was known as D.D. Miller's son for a while until D.D. became known as Ori Miller's father. He absorbed the love of the church from his family, learned respect and accountability. He once said, a person's gifts make room for him or her. That's true, but so did his family connections. D.D. Miller's reputation as a leader among MC Mennonites and Amish Mennonites paved the way for Ori. At Goshen, Ori learned to know the primary leaders of the church and cultivated relationships with his peers, many of whom stepped into important positions of leadership in the Mennonite Church and the General Conference Mennonite Church. Ori's marriage to Elta Wolf, the only daughter of A.N. and Anna Hess Wolf, a family of means, gave Ori a passport into the Lancaster Mennonite Conference. Wealth and respectability, family connections, also gave Ori entree to Lancaster County Mennonite culture, where such credentials mattered. These credentials softened the negative impact of his association with his alma mater, Goshen College, with its reputation among many Easterners as liberal and dangerous. Ori's own disciplined work, with its reputation among many Easterners, and his respect for the leadership, added to his credibility. Above all, Ori was disciplined and focused. We could add such words as methodical, organized, systematic, orderly, efficient. Ori accomplished more than most because he was disciplined and focused. Wilbert Shank, himself disciplined and organized, never met anyone who was more disciplined than Ori Miller. Shank learned from Ori to keep your eye on the big questions. Don't be distracted by the trivial. Edgar Stace recalled that Ori did not try to do everything. He did what he was asked to do, or what he had determined needed to be done, and did not allow himself to be distracted. He followed a daily routine, going to bed at 10 o'clock and getting up by 7, 8 hours. As one house guest observed, one can set a clock by Ori's strict habits. He was fastidious about his appearance. He got a haircut every week, drove to Lancaster to get his shoes shined, and his suits were neatly pressed. Under his gray suit, under his plain coat, he wore a black necktie tucked into his shirt. He simplified life, compensating for his colorblindness by buying only black socks and white or off-white shirts. Ori floundered before he found his gift for administration. At Goshen College, he was going to do 5 other things, and one of them, even after he promised Elta and Elta's father that he was coming to Akron, he felt like he had a call to become a pastor at a nearby church, and so told the family this is what he was going to do, but then later came to his senses, and after he learned that he would not become a pastor by going through the lot at Ephrata 4 times, he found, at age 33, his gift for administration. He was future-focused. Long-range planning was another key to Ori's leadership. One of the frequent questions he would ask me, this is Bill Snyder, who followed him as the executive director of MCC, well, what do we see ahead for the next 3 years? It was almost a reflex. He did not ask that every day, but you knew when you took an idea to him, he wanted to look in those terms ahead, where it would be going. And of course, he was famous for asking everybody, even his grandchildren, what is your 10-year plan? He was visiting David W. Shank at Mogadishu, Somalia, and David Shank was just really eager to show Ori Miller that he had just set up a generator so they could have electricity in the school. Things were really moving ahead. They were walking down the path toward the school, and David Shank said, Brother Miller, would you step aside here? I'd like to show you the generator I just set up. Ori never paused. He kept walking. He said, I expect Mennonites to know how to set up generators. What I want to know is, what is your 10-year plan? David Shank used the same questions for his staff. Don Jacobs remembers that Ori understood the future. He understood what was going on, and we were ready to move with that often. At Eastern Mennonite Missions, we couldn't have done what we did without Ori Miller. I mean, it was just a constant presence, and we had a sort of feeling that Ori could help us solve any problem. And I realized, even though he was not a trained missiologist, I knew that he knew where he was going, and he knew where we should go. It was just sort of uncanny how that worked. So here was a man, so many-sided that it astounded you, but that's what we wanted. We had Harold Bender on the theological side. He was helpful. When it came to interacting with our world, Ori Miller was our man. Part of his forward-looking was keeping up with trends, reading widely, and consulting widely. For example, in 1933, when he and Elam Stauffer from Eastern Mennonite Missions went to look for a mission field in Africa, Ori had communicated, had written with a number of mission agencies, World Dominion, which was a large international organization, and Presbyterians and others. So on the way, they stopped at these offices, five different offices, to get counsel. By the time they hit Dar es Salaam and consulted with a Presbyterian missionary there, they knew where they were going. They had figured it out. And Ori was decisive, ready to make decisions. Bill Snyder remembers there were some things on which he might postpone a decision, but usually he made decisions within the time frame that they needed to be made, and he did not have this debilitating thing of regrets. That is, once a decision was made, he had no second thoughts or regrets. He moved on. Sometimes that got him into difficulty, because sometimes he moved ahead too quickly and did not consider all players. Though he didn't always get it right, Ori could solve problems. A relief worker in Germany said it was amazing how in 1 hour he had the answer to a problem over which we had struggled for weeks. Ori's cryptic judgment during an Eastern Mennonite Missions Tanzania conflict has emerged from multiple sources. When in 1960 the independent Tanganyika Mennonite Church was writing its constitution, Eastern Mennonite Missions sent the conference discipline guidelines to be included. How could the daughter church say no to the mother church? Lancaster Conference standards were increasingly irrelevant in Africa. Ori said, "We'll fix it. Put it in a file and forget it." He learned a great deal about leadership during his 15 months in the Middle East doing service after World War I. He wrote glowingly about Red Cross Major James H. Nicol, who kept promoting Ori. From one job to the next, he became quartermaster, he became commanding officer. He was amused by the CO, commanding officer, CO, conscientious objector, but he would sign for all supplies in the entire Beirut district. It didn't always work. Al Meyer tells the tale when he was in Europe. He was helping French Mennonites to recover from the war, and they had expectations of what Mennonite Central Committee could do and what the French needed. And one time, Ori came visiting, and he told Al Meyer that this couple that was serving for the French Mennonites should be moved to Algeria. Al said, "They've just been married. They just have a young child. They'll live in the desert. They can't do this." Ori insisted. Al Meyer said, "I'll resign before I do that." Well, Ori consulted John Howard Yoder, also in Europe. John Howard Yoder said, "I'll resign too." It didn't happen. But Al's observation was that it never affected his relationship with Ori or Ori's with him. It wasn't personal. It wasn't about his ego. He was prepared. He was ahead of everyone, some said. Edgar Stace, Ori led by being ahead of everybody in the room. He was more prepared than the others in the subject matter, and he always had a plan. You know, I have always resented a bit this opinion that a lot of people seem to have that Ori wrote minutes ahead of meetings. You've heard it, right? He says that's a cheap shot. Ori came to meetings prepared. He knew what he wanted out of the meeting, and more often than not, he got it. And he got it without dominating the airtime. Rather, he got it by having something to put on the table. He did not dominate by the force of his personality, but by the force of his ideas. Delegation was his art. He gave those to whom he delegated a great deal of freedom within a broad framework, or he had a fairly simple formula for getting things done. You see where you want to go, then you find the right people to take you there. He was a strategically wise planner. For example, when the 1948 World Conference was to be planned in North America, to be hosted by Mennonites in North America, the old Mennonite church said, no way. We're not going to fellowship with all those worldly general conference and other kinds of Mennonites. And worldwide fellowship is an illusion. No, we can't do it. Well, Ori and Harold Bender got together and said, well, you know what? I think we can make this happen. So MCC planned the conference in 1948. It was a way of getting it done, but also getting around church leadership. He was financially astute. One protege said, I never saw anyone who could comprehend a financial report so quickly. He would often say, but I wanted to be an evangelist. But every time I turned around, people were asking me to raise money, to count money, and to manage money. He was also quietly persistent. And here's a story. He and Harold Bender were the movers and shakers in many Mennonite committees and boards. In this case, there was a meeting of the Mennonite Church Peace Problems Committee. Harold Bender was the chair. Harold Bender was running the meeting. Harold Bender and Guy Hirschberger, the recording secretary, got into a tiff about some detail, and they couldn't get it done. Ori Miller raised his hand. He said, Brother Chairman, I make a motion that you two brethren go to another room and resolve your personal differences while we work on world differences. Bender, I reject that motion. Ori waited a bit. Then he said, Brother Vice Chairman, John E. Lapp of Franconia, I make a motion these two brothers go to another room and resolve their differences while we go on with the meeting with you leading us. John Lapp was wise enough to take the sense of the meeting, and these two men walked out like they were going to a spanking. When they came back in, Vice Chairman John Lapp said, have you resolved your differences? Yes, we have. Okay, Bender, you can chair the meeting again. The other amazing thing about Ori is that he had an uncanny ability to spot talent and called hundreds of people into service. I imagine there are some of you here who were called into service by Ori Miller. Would you raise your hand if you were? Okay. He had this bird's eye view of the Mennonite matrix. He was a member of every boarding committee, so he knew what was needed. He also knew a great many people, young people in particular, especially coming out of the civilian public service. Harry Martins once said, I can never figure out why, but every time God calls me to do something, he uses Ori Miller's voice. Now, it didn't always work. It usually worked, but not always. Some people said no to Ori Miller, as the case of Francis Bontrager Greaser, who felt no call to go to Belize as a teacher. She felt a call to go back to Ethiopia as a nurse. The Eastern Mennonite Board could not convince her. Ori Miller could not convince her. So he took her home to Akron that night. She slept in Elta's nightgown and prayed about this thing again and again. Next morning, she took a long walk. And she sat in a culvert, and she cried, and she prayed. When she came back, Ori said, what have you decided? She said, I've said yes 1,000 times, but I've said no 1,001 times. But don't you know this is God's will for you? But Ori, you're not God. he would always ask an occasion like this, what do you want to do? She wanted to come down here to Eastern Mennonite and study nursing. Ori Miller made the phone call. On Monday, she was here, and President Mumal was waiting on the lawn to receive her. Ori could make things happen. He had an informal strategy, and his organizations outgrew him. Paul Krabel, his successor at Eastern Mennonite Missions, was increasingly frustrated because Ori Miller would make decisions on the spot in Korea or Europe or wherever it was, and then Paul Krabel had to undo it. So at the end, it didn't work quite so well. One story that capsulizes all of this, and I need to make it short, Rachel. MCC workers and university students and missionaries in Europe during Reconstruction after World War II had concerns about top-down leadership from Akron. They, including Cal Redekop, asked for a meeting with the executive committee. They met in Basel, Switzerland, and five presented their papers, one after another, all critical of top-down leadership from Akron. At the end of those presentations, Ori broke down and cried. He sobbed. And Cal said, we felt terrible. Here was a man who called us into service, he showed us the world, and he's bawling. Well, he got over it, and then he said, okay, let's discuss this. He had also said, if this is how you feel, I'm going to go home and resign. He went home to resign, but the board wouldn't take his resignation. Others thought they should have, because he was nearing the end of his effectiveness. Didn't always work, amazingly effective, but the world outgrew him in some ways. Rachel.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you, John, so much for this presentation of a 20th century Mennonite leader. And I also want to thank Jim Smucker and the Conference Planning Committee for inviting me to be part of this presentation and conference, to offer a critical appraisal, and to be part of these conversations this week. From John's careful mining of the archival sources, we glean some indicators of Ori Miller's gifts of leadership and how he nurtured and exercised his own talents and moved across many communities, essentially as an activist, prizing productivity and a kind of perpetual motion, just really incredible. Among the insights that John's biographical work, My Calling to Fulfill, provides for us is that Ori Miller also recognized the gifts of leadership of other people and encouraged them. John's insights that we've just heard suggest that Miller was a Mennonite leader whom we might fairly characterize as one who led others to embrace many, many Mennonite institutional projects. Civilian public service is just one of those many. That while conservative and paternalistic in some ways, also emphasized progressivism and certainly a global outlook. And all of this was combined with a very, very strong loyalty to the church. Certainly, we can recognize that in bringing an entrepreneurial spirit and financial backing to institutions in which Ori Miller expended much energy, the accomplishments and productivity that we associate with him were not his alone. Clearly, he was part of a generation of Mennonite leaders, some of them academics, some of them ordained ministers, none of them with the exact same set of skills or background that Ori Miller had, but all within a fairly narrow range of what many early to mid-20th century Mennonites regarded as leader types. Male, white, European, North American in family background and experience, highly educated, theologically grounded in a faith tradition acculturated to regard leaders as having these attributes. And Mennonites, who have a heritage of revering leaders of past generations, have put significant resources into producing biographies of such men. The denominational publishing house, Herald Press, for example, has worked hard at this. Our academic historians at EMU, Heston, Goshen, Bluffton, and elsewhere have, in a way, made it their mission in the late 20th century and right up to the present day to tell the stories of these individuals and the organizations that they built and developed and led. A handout that you receive in your packet, and you may want to open this up and find it, is titled Selected Resources, and it has the title of our afternoon topic here of this session, Changing Patterns of Leadership in Anabaptist Communities. So I invite you to pull that out. This handout perhaps can help us to think about this substantive effort at preserving, narrating, and disseminating models of Mennonite leadership in recent years. While the sources listed here are certainly not an exhaustive listing, the top four entries that you'll see are all similar in genre. They're biographies of leaders, and they tell a particular set of stories. Perry Bush's new work on C. Henry Smith, Al Kimes' much-read volume authored here at Harrisonburg on H.S. Bender, Theron Schlaubach's exhaustively researched book on Guy F. Hirschberger, and our focus today, John Sharp's accessibly written The Ori O. Miller Story. Our session this afternoon, as indicated on this sheet, is titled Changing Patterns of Leadership in the 20th Century. And it's a concept that I, as a Mennonite historian, really value. Historians like to mull over the concept of change over time. How are our models for leadership today in 2016 different from the models that were in vogue at the time that Ori O. Miller or Harold S. Bender, say, reached the peak of their power? All of these men, the focus of these biographies, were, of course, products of their times, part of patriarchal family and institutional structures, privileged by their race, gender, access to education and mobility, and they were embedded in particular Christian theological traditions that in the mid-20th century heyday of missionary and colonizing projects allowed them to exercise leadership. John Sharp reports that Ori Miller on his first trip of, what did you say, 30 to Paraguay, right? Some 30 trips to Paraguay. This first trip was in 1931, described the Lingua Indian tribe whom he encountered as workers on the expanding Mennonite settlements as, quote, quote, most primitive and having, quote, child minds in every way. That's a quote from Ori Miller. This language of a cultural appropriation and the certitude it evinces causes us to wince. We know that key elements of the worldviews of MCC leaders some 80 years ago are regarded as anachronistic today. In that context, at times these men modeled leadership in ways that many of us today would question, would reject. Now, we too are products of our times. Clearly, it's useful to examine older models of getting things done with as much empathy as we can muster, to try to step into the shoes of historical figures whom we're hoping to understand and learn from. And stepping in shoes is quite an apt metaphor for trying to get clarity on Ori O. Miller, the consummate shoe salesman. That's what he did for a living. But at a conference like this one, broadly focused on Anabaptist values, comparative and contrasting approaches are also helpful. What do we learn by studying biographies that focus laser-like attention on one or two or three individual leaders? What are we missing by taking that approach? And how have historians in recent decades been adjusting lenses and frameworks to help us better understand Anabaptist institutions, both here and globally? If you look at this handout again, you'll note that the bottom two-thirds of citations fall under the category of historical works and alternative perspectives. Unlike the first four books cited, these publications and websites are not focused on individual Mennonite leaders. This is an eclectic sampling, but in general, they all come at leadership via different approaches, often looking at moments in our collective past in which people pushed for change by enlarging the faith community's vision of who might be a leader and redefining how they might be a leader or how they might lead. What we find here are people whose leadership was not always so easily recognized in their time and place as that of an Ori Miller or an H.S. Bender. In contrast to Miller and Bender, other 20th century Mennonites with less name recognition and less authority, and whose racial or cultural identity or gender lobbed them outside the circle of recognizable leaders, also acted as change agents. But their modes of acting may have been different for a host of reasons. Perhaps they lacked financial resources or lacked ethnic family connections to Mennonite seats of power. They may have faced discrimination because of the color of their skin, or the language they spoke, or because if they were female, they received little schooling and no encouragement to follow a calling. They may have engaged with Anabaptist institutions, but found disappointingly that these institutions, at least at times, were exclusionary. In other words, individuals and groups who sought to counter paternalism, colonialism, patriarchy, sexism, homophobia within and beyond Mennonite church congregations and institutions were also leaders, often not recognized as such, but leaders nevertheless. A few examples for which we now have meticulously researched and persuasively argued history include these. An example, interracial couples, women and men who married each other, African Americans and whites in the 1950s and 60s, despite considerable social stigma, and brought their gifts, insofar as they were able, into American Mennonite institutions in the face of racial prejudice. You can read about them and other change agents in Tobin Miller Shearer's book, Daily Demonstrators, The Civil Rights Movement in Mennonite Homes and Sanctuaries. Or if you haven't read it yet, pick up a copy of Latino Mennonites. Felipe Hinojosa, a Texas-based history professor who has researched this book using many Spanish and English language sources, says that, quote, "My challenge was to try and reassess the motivations, politics, and contradictions of Latina religious activism, Puerto Rican, Mexican-American, and more. The clearest example of this black-brown coalition within the Mennonite Church was the Minority Ministries Council, which organized in 1968 and worked to transform the church into a more inclusive space for people of color. As one of the few inter-ethnic religious groups in the U.S. during the Civil Rights era, the politics and organizing of these leaders were a big reason why Latinas and Latinos remained invested in fighting for inclusion in a largely white and rural church with a strong peace tradition," end of quote from Felipe Hinojosa. Mennonite ethnicity, as well as gender, and the rich legacy of Mennonite women's experiences moving into leadership roles are being documented in a variety of ways, all the more so now in the 21st century. In recent decades, institutional presidencies of Mennonite colleges and an Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary have gone to women. The handout that you have in front of you lists near the bottom of the page the URL for Women in Leadership Project, which is a multi-ethnic initiative to dismantle sexism in Mennonite Church USA. And also listed in the bottom two-thirds of this sheet is Crossing the Line, Women of Anabaptist Traditions. That's an interdisciplinary conference being planned by leaders on this very campus, historians Mary Sprunger and Kimberly Schmidt, to explore the limits and boundaries pressed upon women of an earlier day, and also to examine the remarkable expressions of agency, both among women from North American Mennonite communities and the extraordinary directions that Anabaptist women are heading these days in the Global South. I invite you to put the dates of this conference on your calendar for June 2017 next year and return here to EMU to participate in what promises to be a great interplay of ideas. By way of conclusion, let's return to the notion of changing patterns of leadership, which links back to Ori Miller and the activist bent that he exemplified. By living long and well, Miller had the opportunity to interact with many Mennonites of a younger generation. One of those who learned from him was my own mentor, Robert S. Kreider, whose name is also listed near the bottom section of your handout. Born in 1919 in Illinois and passing away just this past December at his Kansas home, Robert too lived most of his life in the 20th century and exuded leadership that we might regard as exemplary. The citation listed here is a piece I recently wrote about him for the Bethel College Alumni Magazine Context as a way of working through my own grief for an elder scholar, churchman, and friend who has meant a great deal to me. In his last years, Robert Kreider served as one of a number of close advisors to John Sharp in his biography writing project about Ori Miller, and I know John would have his own stories of appreciation about Robert. Over the years, Robert shared with me many, many documents from his files. He had a lot. He really did not like to throw anything away. One of my prized possessions from him is a single page that he typed up in 1985, when I was working alongside him on a couple of book projects, including a volume on MCC's history. This document of his was essentially a list, which he titled A Kind of Credo, My Preferences as They May Relate to Mennonite History. And he wrote on this sheet, quote, "I prefer to examine issues in their interrelatedness and bondings, the search for motifs, patterns, themes, and designs, the context of a Christian community, the many shades of gray," end quote. I wish to suggest that that line of Robert's, penned in 1985, "The Many Shades of Gray," signifies a forward movement in Anabaptist leadership. We might interpret that line in many ways, among them the embrace of questioning, of not being afraid to re-examine decision-making, of bearing witness to faith in faith and life, and a relishing of inclusivity. All of us know leaders among us, and leaders who have gone before us, who have contributed to changing patterns of leadership in Anabaptist communities. May we be wise in listening to their diverse and sometimes discordant voices. Thank you. You can almost just... Yeah.
So thank you, John and Rachel, very much. So what we're going to do now, we have a few minutes for Q&A. How we'd like to structure this time is for you in the audience to think for a minute of questions or comments that you would like to pose, and take 2 minutes to turn to the person next to you and share those questions or comments that you would have as a way to kind of get yourself grounded and have thoughtful kind of discussion on the material that was just presented. And then Dave is going to come around with a mic, and others, and Weil will come around with a mic. So right now, turn to the person next to you. We'll just take 1 to 2 minutes, and then we will open up for the comments on mic and questions. So do we have our first comment or question for Rachel and John over here?
Thank you to both of you. My question is about Ori Miller's family, his spouse and his children. I've read your book and enjoyed it very much, John. What does that teach us about leadership or lack of leadership when someone is so engaged in their ministry that the family, I can only imagine, suffers at some point? How much could be talked about at that time, I don't know. But I mean, that whole thing, what does that say about leadership and being future-focused and all of that? So, Ori's family.
It says a great deal. And the shadow side of his life is his absenteeism as a father and as a husband. Time and time again, he would write from some hotel anywhere in the world, "Oh, Elta, I feel so badly. I've been gone so much. I really have to change my ways and be a better husband to you." Of course, he never did. And I think the John W., his son, said it best. He said, "My mother suffered quietly when he was gone so much." Yeah.
Another question or comment?
Did you see any evidence during the lifetime of leaders of Ori Miller and his generation that their leadership evolved and changed along with how they interacted with people and their projects?
Want to comment about that?
One example I would give was that many of these people had an opportunity to work in civilian public service. Ori was one of the architects, of course, of that program. That program brought together Mennonites from about every stripe, and Amish people, and Brethren folk, and Catholics, and people who were of the Molokan sect from Russia, and just a whole variety of people that tended to open up the world views of folks who connected with civilian public service. And that program lasted for 5 years. That was not just a blip in the lives of these people. That was a very significant 5 years. So I think perhaps more than almost any other institution that we could talk about, that was a change agent in and of itself. And so, yes, I think there was more openness in many of these institutions as a result of that program that Ori and these other folks had given. It was their dream that something like this could be a possibility. It represented such an improvement over the way conscientious objectors had been treated during the First World War. So that would be one example.
The other thing to say about that is Ori took quite a hit from some in the church, who believed that CPS was dangerous because of the interrelatedness of all these other people. And there was especially a pretty harsh interrogation here in Harrisonburg in 1941. And Ori mostly sat and listened, responded as he could. But part of leading for him was absorbing the hostility. And those who knew him back in Akron said he never talked about that.
Thank you very much for these descriptions. It seems like Ori Miller was a man ahead of his time and implemented a number of leadership styles that were new to his era. But then you say the world got ahead of him, or the generation got ahead of him. And I guess my question is, what happened that he didn't continue to keep questioning the status quo and finding new ways to lead when he had done that earlier in life?
Do you want to comment? He got old, for one thing, and probably tired. But he also learned to trust the younger generation, Cal Redicop and company, and would on occasion give in to them and acknowledge that, yeah, the world was changing and I need to step aside. Cal's generation would not put up with that kind of a pyramid leadership structure.
One thing I thought about when I was listening to your question is that I've heard John Sharp say in another setting that Ori Miller did not second-guess himself very much. Is that fair to say,
That's
John?
True. Mm-hmm.
And it could be that as someone like Ori gets older, but the challenges are somewhat new challenges by the end of the 20th century. If you don't second-guess yourself, it is a little hard to adapt with those changing times. I mean, your comments earlier this session about the millennials having not necessarily needing new models of leadership, but they become models, I think is relevant here. There's a new generation coming up, and how you adapt and realize the way you've always done it isn't going to be the way new people will be doing it may have been a factor for him.
One other thing to say is we don't allow people to have that kind of leadership, that kind of authority, even Lawrence Horsentruber.
I have a question about Ori Miller in the context of his times beyond the Mennonite Church. One of the things that surprised me when I spent a year at Valparaiso University in the office of O.P. Kretzmann was that Lutherans had these kinds of leaders too, and other academic institutions had these kinds of leaders too, and I had the impression that this kind of leadership was a Mennonite way of doing things, and it turns out, at least in one example, to be perhaps the 1950s.
Do you have a comment?
Yeah, I mean, just even economically, you know, Ori Miller, I mean, it's very clear from John's book, Ori Miller was a very solidly mid-20th century American capitalist. And that goes directly to your point. I mean, in that, he had much in common with many other people. At the same time, I would add that he did not fit that mold perfectly because he practiced what he preached when he said, you don't want to die a rich man, mm-hmm. right? That's not the usual gospel of American prosperity. So, you know, there were differences that he brought that I think were infusing some Anabaptist ideas about even economics and so forth, but really appreciate your comment.
My question builds on that one.
Back there, and then we'll come back there.
My question builds on that one. If is there anything particularly Anabaptist or Mennonite about the trajectory of change that you have outlined between the 1950s and now?
Go ahead and then I'll respond.
I would say yes. One could argue that the what Jim Yonke calls semi-episcopal structures of the old Mennonite church that allowed for strong leadership like this were not sustained. And a new generation said enough. Harold Bender's Anabaptism, and especially his students, picked up. Cal Redicop, again, is one. And I have often said they had their strong disagreements with Harold Bender over theology and history. And I say that his students were more Catholic than the Pope. In other words, the students learned Anabaptism well, and their trajectory was to a more egalitarian structure of relationships.
I would say that there are so many commonalities that Anabaptists, certainly in the North American context, have with other Christian groups, mainline Christian groups, and as the end of the 20th century unfolded and we come into the 21st century, many of the challenges we find in all of our institutions seem to be shared by brothers and sisters that we have in other denominations. So I guess I would not overemphasize Mennonite exceptionalism in leadership. I would be wary of that.
This may be a... Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
This may be a bit of an esoteric question, but I have a problem in a sense with your, Rachel, with your comment that Ori had said that he did not intend to die a rich man. There's a bit of an irony here that I'm still not clear, John, and you and I need to talk about this, whether this was, his not dying a rich man was not an intentional issue. There were some other factors involved in that. That made sure that he didn't die a rich man. So this is an esoteric question that may not be appropriate to be discussed here.
Yeah, we should have that conversation. The simple response is that he gave away so much of it, and it was so much fun to track his spending and his giving and his earnings. But the other problem was the shoe company went bankrupt soon after Ori died, and so the stocks that he had invested in were worthless. And those he assumed would go on to support his widow and family.
Well, we are at our time at 5:00, so thank you so much, John and Rachel. So, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Really good to be on the stage with you. Yeah.
Really well done.
So, thank you very much for this historical perspective of leadership. And the book to inspire this conference. I just have a couple of announcements really quickly. So tonight we hope you will join us back here where we have a presentation by Brian Welch. And now there's dinner on your own. If you are a speaker, you have a ticket for a meal together with other speakers in the EMU cafeteria. So you can go through the line and then join us in the West Dining Room if you're a speaker. Also, a small announcement is, if you're leaving, if it's going to be your last session, we do want to recycle, reuse our name badges. You can drop it in a box as you're leaving. So we do want to reuse those. So we will hopefully see you back here at 7:00.